Add life to you, add link to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. That's me, and this is that. In the year we've been doing this program, we've been hearing what voters want. We've been covering the issues, the horse race, the history, and the trivia, now and then accompanied by a rare insert of humor. Some will say very rare. But it's always been all politics. And this is the big one. More than one-third of the Senate is up, along with all members of the House and 36 governorships. Will it be a wave election, like the Republicans had in 2010 or the Democrats experienced in 2006? Or will it be inconclusive? What will it mean for the last 2 years of the Obama presidency? And what might it tell us about 2016? We have an all-star lineup of analysts and reporters here in the studio and out in the field to tell us. But first, as always, this week's trivia question. At least one independent, Greg Orman of Kansas, is given a decent shot at winning election to the Senate this year. If that happens, he would join two other Senate independents, Angus King of Maine and Bernie Sanders of Vermont. Before King and Sanders, who was the last senator elected to his first term who won as neither a Democrat nor a Republican? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. And there's no need to ever wait for the weekly trivia question. Hop over to the Political Junkie page on Facebook. We post the trivia question for fans only every Wednesday. And there's other great stuff on the page, too. That's the Political Junkie on Facebook. We're the one with the button. We'll give you the answer to last week's trivia question later in the show, so stick around. The 2014 midterm elections are right around the corner, and so much is up in the air. Hundreds of millions of dollars spent, we've been inundated with polls, with claims, with negative ads. The year of the woman, the war on women, the war on coal, Ebola, ISIS, Obamacare, personhood, Benghazi, the Koch brothers, the IRS, the Bergdahl swap, Fangate, plagiarism, abortion, the government shutdown, immigration, castrating hogs, the George Washington Bridge. Somehow we made it this far. Now it's up to the voters. But before we talk about November 4th, let's take a step back and figure out how we got here. We start the program with Vin Weber, a former Republican congressman from Minnesota, GOP strategist, and the co-chairman of the Mercury Public Relations firm, and Anna Greenberg, a Democratic strategist and pollster, the senior vice president of the Greenberg Quinlan Rosner Research Firm. For those with good memories, we used to have both Vin and Anna on the Political Junkie segments on Talk of the Nation. I'm thrilled to have you both in the studio here today. Anna and Vin, welcome to the program.
It's always great to be with you in a different setting than we used to be together, but always fun to be with you.
Anna, are you also happy?
I am. The gang is back together.
Yeah. Great reunion.
Well, Vin, the last time I think all of the three of us were in the same room together, it was right after the election of 2012. President Obama won a big second-term victory, sweeping nearly every battleground state. The Democrats actually picked up seats in the Senate, which they weren't supposed to do. It was not a good time for the Republican Party. It was not a good time for Vin Weber. Next Tuesday, a better night for the GOP?
Well, I think a lot better. We'll see how much better, but and we won't know how much better until we actually dig a little bit into the entrails of the election. But just on from the top line, Anna will argue the other side. I think Republicans are going to take control of the Senate. I think we're going to gain 10 or so seats in the House, which will put us at very near a historic high for House Republicans. And I think, not discussed a lot, but I think we're going to gain a record number of state legislatures around the country. So I think it will be a good night on the top line. What I'm interested in is seeing if it shows progress with some of the constituencies we need to work on, Hispanics, Asians, women, young people.
What causes this? I mean, obviously a lot is about President Obama, but are there better Republican candidates this year?
Those are the two issues. I mean, President Obama is the main thing. And it's not just President Obama. Every president has trouble in midterm elections. Sometimes it's greater, sometimes it's lesser. It was tremendously bad for Republicans in 2006 when George W. Bush was the incumbent president. It's going to be bad for the Democrats, in my view, next Tuesday, because President Obama's approval rating is bouncing around 40%. And in some of the key red state Senate seats, it's below 40%. But also, the Republicans avoided some of the embarrassing candidates that you and I and Anna talked about, Anna gleefully and me crying over it, over the last couple of cycles. We've got good candidates.
You talk about the Todd Akins, the Richard Murdochs. I'm sorry.
No, I'm not talking about them. If you want to talk about them, I'll let you, but I'm not going to.
I didn't mean to mention that, sorry.
No, but we haven't had any bad candidates. I have to say, in all fairness, the Democrats have good incumbents, too. That's why some of these races are very close. But the Republicans have had good candidates this year.
Anna, do you agree with that assessment?
Look, I don't think you and I disagree all that much, generally speaking, from year to year. And it's not going to be a great year for Democrats. As you said, the midterm 6 years into an incumbent president's term is hardly ever a good year. And it's made even worse by the president's approval ratings. And not just that, if you just look at how people feel about how things are going in the country, our right track, wrong track numbers just haven't really been all that different for over like 4 years. Mm-hmm. So you have about 62 to 65% of the country saying that things are going in the wrong direction. So that's never good for the incumbent party. What I think is interesting is compared to 2010, it's definitely going to be a better year, but I still don't think it's going to be a great year. And I'd say I still think it's 50-50 on the Senate. I wouldn't be surprised if Democrats lose the Senate, but I think it's certainly possible to keep the Senate.
We're not far off.
And when we started this race, everybody was talking about the government shutdown or the botched rollout of the Obamacare. Neither issue seems to be highlighted by candidates of either side this cycle.
Certainly, Obamacare, generally speaking, and the rollout and other aspects of it has played a really, really almost an indirect role in the sense that it's obviously been part of the president's approval ratings. But I think it's just been litigated too many times. I mean, you've had the 2010 election, the 2012 election. It's being implemented. It's working in many places. The Supreme Court has said that it's constitutional. It's a little bit old news, and you saw the Republicans start really strong at the beginning of the cycle advertising on it and have really moved away from it. And for them, similarly, it's a proof point that somebody's too close to Obama. So if you voted against repeal, that's a proof point that you're too close to Obama. Right. And it's more that than an attack on someone's position on Obamacare.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Republicans are still talking about Obamacare a lot, and the polls say it's still a pretty good issue for them. But Anna's on to really the important point of it. I talked to a couple of Senate candidates last summer even who told me, interestingly, the Obamacare issue was no longer primarily, as strange as this may sound, a health care issue. It was a symbol of opposition to the president, a symbol of big government, a symbol of overregulation. And Obamacare was the shorthand way people had of identifying all of their disenchantment if they were disenchanted with Obama and big government. And that's a little different than in the last several elections where Obamacare, specifically the failure of the website and things like that, were the kind of issues we were talking about.
Just in case neither of you have sat in front of a TV in recent weeks, let me just play you some of the ads. Here's a Republican ad in Alaska.
Mark Begich votes with Obama 97% of the time for Obamacare, trillions in new debt, job-killing EPA regulations.
I'm not on the ballot this fall. But make no mistake, these policies are on the ballot.
Okay, here's an ad in Louisiana.
Mary Landrieu voted for every one of Obama's liberal activist judges. Every single one. Even the liberal justices who rubber-stamped Obamacare and voted against your Second Amendment right of armed self-defense.
Anna, you mentioned North Carolina.
In Washington, Senator Hagan votes with President Obama 96% of the time. But now we know the truth. They told us the biggest lie of the year.
And here's CNN's Wolf Blitzer asking a question in a debate in New Hampshire.
Senator Shaheen, you voted with President Obama 99% of the time, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Quarterly. So here's the question to you. How is a vote for you not a vote for President Obama and his policies?
I wish the listeners could see Vin and Anna's face as we were playing these commercials. Anna, let's start with you. Is this fair?
Well, I think it is certainly if you have objective statistics about how often somebody has voted in favor of a piece of legislation that the president supports, I don't see why one wouldn't point that out. But I think it's already baked into the election. It's not new information. I mean, part of the reason why Democrats are having challenges this cycle is because of Obama's unpopularity. So I never think those ads give new information. I think that they mobilize base Republican voters, but they're not. It's not new information to voters. And especially those kinds of ads at the end, there's nothing new about that information for a voter.
But Vin, you remember in 2006, that's exactly what Democrats did with George W. Bush. My opponent ran, you know, voted with President Bush 97% of the time.
Yeah, it's easier than getting at specific issues and saying, for instance, my opponent voted supports President Obama on the minimum wage. Wait, so does everybody else. But as long as it's framed generally in terms of Obama policies, it reminds people that they don't like Obama at the moment.
You're listening to the Political Junkie Midterm Election Special. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. If Republicans do win control of the Senate, and I think they will, what's the final 2 years of the Obama administration going to look like?
Well, I think there are a few things. One, I think you're going to see judicial nominations and approvals come to a screeching halt, either because they will not approve, mostly because they won't approve the nominees that the president puts up. So I think that will just end. I think you will see more legislation passed and make it to the president's desk, but I wouldn't overestimate how much more for two reasons. One, you still have a very recalcitrant Tea Party faction in the House. It might get bigger, depending on who wins. And they don't have a ton of interest in compromising, and there are actually some people in the Senate who are more moderate than folks in the House. So there may be some real problems with the caucuses of both chambers getting together. And then finally, there are a lot of people running for president in the Senate, and they all have their own agenda. And so, Ted Cruz has no friends in the Senate. And so I think some of the grandstanding and posturing around the people who are running for president in the Senate may actually make it more difficult to get pieces of legislation passed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with most of that. I think Anna, first of all, hit on one very important thing. The Republicans are determined to show that the legislative branch can work better if they control both houses. And so, as Anna said, I think they will pass more legislation. Mitch McConnell, assuming he comes back as the majority leader, promised we're going to allow votes that Harry Reid is not now allowing. We're going to vote on House legislation. We're going to do conference committees. The legislative branch is going to work more as it should work, in our view. That doesn't mean we're not going to confront the president. And the president's attitude on this matters a lot, too. I think there'll be confrontation over some things for sure, like Supreme Court appointments, judicial appointments, and energy policy. It seems like the administration is going one way on energy policy, and if you look at the new alignment of committee chairs on the Republican side, we're going another way on energy policy. That'll probably be a confrontation, too. But there might be some possibility of working together on things like trade agreements, maybe even a more modest version of tax reform, possibly immigration. I don't want to get overly optimistic because optimism has not been rewarded in this town for a long time, but I think there is a chance that we could produce some positive things in the next couple of years.
Final call, Vin, you say the Republicans take the Senate?
52 or 53 seats.
Anna?
I say Democrats keep it 50-50 with Biden as the deciding vote.
That's the safest prediction you could possibly make and be loyal to your party.
I won't disagree with that.
Vin Weber is a former Republican congressman from Minnesota and the co-chair of the Mercury Public Relations Firm. Vin, great to see you again, and thanks for being on the program.
Great to be with you, as always, and especially nice to be back with Anna.
Anna Greenberg is a Democratic strategist, the senior vice president of the Greenberg Quinlan Rosner Research Firm. Anna, same with you. Thank you, and thank you for one thing. And I hope we can get you both back on the show as we approach 2016.
That's what I say. Sure. Let's get together again.
When we come back, we'll try to figure out who might take the majority in the Senate.
Gosh, there's still so many close races.
Kansas.
Georgia.
Iowa. Louisiana.
It's like a choose-your-own-adventure. So many different scenarios.
All that and more after the break. I'm Ken Rudin. You're listening to The Political Junkie. Stick around.
WILL programming is made possible by Sinfonia de Camera, presenting Menachem and Mozart on Saturday, November 8th at 7:30 p.m. in the Fullinger Great Hall at Krannert. Pianist and founder of the Beaux-Arts Trio, Menachem Pressler, joins Sinfonia in an all-Mozart program.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Political Junkie Midterm Election Special. I'm Ken Rudin. Coming up on the show, a comprehensive look at the key Senate and gubernatorial races at stake this year. But first, it's time for This Week in Political History.
The following pre-recorded political program is sponsored by TV for Goldwater Miller on behalf of Barry Goldwater, Republican candidate for President of the United States.
It came at the crossroads of a political movement. 50 years ago this week, a presidential campaign was coming to a crushing defeat, but the campaign's philosophy found a new champion.
Ladies and gentlemen, we take pride in presenting a thoughtful address by Ronald Reagan. Mr. Reagan.
Thank you.
In 1964, Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater, a longtime conservative stalwart, won the Republican presidential nomination. But his bid for the White House was doomed on two fronts. One, he was running as the nation was mourning President Kennedy's assassination and extending its embrace to a new president. And two, his rhetoric about Vietnam, nuclear weapons, civil rights, extremism, turned off millions of Americans.
I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
Even many of his fellow Republicans didn't take to his tone. He would go on to lose in one of the greatest landslides in presidential election history. Enter Ronald Reagan, an actor, an ex-Democrat turned Republican, and a strong Goldwater backer. On October 27, 1964, Reagan delivered a speech called A Time for Choosing. It was part of a pre-recorded TV program and was his first entry into national politics. It was a big one. He talked about the nation's economic woes.
We haven't balanced our budget 28 out of the last 34 years. We've raised our debt limit three times in the last 12 months. And now our national debt is 1.5 times bigger than all the combined debts of all the nations of the world.
And communism.
When Nikita Khrushchev has told his people, he knows what our answer will be. He has told them that we're retreating under the pressure of the Cold War, and someday, when the time comes to deliver the final ultimatum, our surrender will be voluntary, because by that time, we will have been weakened from within spiritually, morally, and economically.
And he made the case for Senator Goldwater.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness. We will keep in mind and remember that Barry Goldwater has faith in us. He has faith that you and I have the ability and the dignity and the right to make our own decisions and determine our own destiny. Thank you very much.
Goldwater hoped to lead the conservative movement to the promised land. He didn't. He got as far as Moses. But his candidacy was the beginning of the party's rightward ascendancy. And it launched the political career of Ronald Reagan. 2 years later, Reagan would be elected governor of California by a margin of 1 million votes. In 1981, he would become the nation's 40th president.
But I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
And will to the best of my ability.
And will to the best of my ability.
But it was a speech Ronald Reagan gave 50 years ago this week on behalf of Barry Goldwater and conservatism that launched his political career. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The story everyone is watching is whether the Republicans will win a Senate majority. Many thought they'd do it 2 years ago. They didn't. Well, they're back at it again this year. They need a net gain of 6 to make Mitch McConnell majority leader. We'll have reports today from the battleground states of Kansas, Louisiana, and Iowa. But here for an overview, we have Greg Giroux, a political reporter for Bloomberg Politics, who's closely following Senate races. Greg, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
Great to be with you, Ken.
The conventional wisdom this whole cycle is that the Republicans take the Senate. I still think that's the case, but there may be some late-minute surprises out there.
Well, it's certainly one of the most consequential and interesting Senate elections I can remember in a long time, and there are just so many different scenarios under which so many different paths by which Republicans could get to that 51-seat majority from the 45 they have now. I mean, I'm looking at, you know, at least 13 highly competitive races. There are at least, I think, 10 on the Democratic side worth watching. But what makes these Senate elections very interesting is the prospect of overtime. You have one runoff seemingly highly likely, one possible. You have an independent running in Kansas against a Republican incumbent there, and then you have the prospect of a possibly long count in a state like Alaska.
One race that has a lot of uncertainty is in Louisiana. That's where Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu, who's seeking a fourth term in a state where President Obama's numbers are terrible, she faces two Republicans. It's quite possible, Greg, as you mentioned, that no one will get a majority on Tuesday, and if that's the case, according to state law, it'll go to a runoff on December 6th. Here to tell us more about that race is Jeremy Alford. He's the publisher and editor of Law Politics, short for LouisianaPolitics.com. Jeremy, thanks for being on the program again. What's the latest wrinkle?
Yeah, people keep asking me which way this race is leaning, and you know the attack ads have been on since before Christmas, and I feel like we're all starting to lean sideways at this point. You have Landrieu leading Cassidy in the primary from 1 to 7 points. But short of the 50% plus one that she would need to pull out a victory in this jungle primary in Louisiana. So this thing's probably headed to a runoff.
President Obama is very unpopular in Louisiana. How much of that is a factor?
It is the factor. Bill Cassidy and the Republicans have constructed a campaign that is a referendum on Barack Obama. They spent a great deal of time linking Mary Landrieu to Barack Obama through her votes, through her just personal appearances. And it's kind of interesting because there's been so much time and effort spent on that that Bill Cassidy really still hasn't properly introduced himself to voters statewide. You know, he represents a district that runs from Baton Rouge and then kind of down the bayou towards the coast. But just a few months ago, he was still somewhat unknown outside of that region. Mary Landrieu is the last statewide elected Democrat. Obama is an albatross hanging around their necks. And, you know, I asked a consultant when Democrats in Louisiana might be able to get from under that, and he kind of laughs and said, whenever they elect a new president.
Jeremy Alford is the editor and publisher of LawPolitics.com. Thanks so much, Jeremy.
Thanks.
Greg Giroux, Louisiana is only one of the Democrats' potential headaches. There are three states, I think we both agree, that they're likely to lose: West Virginia, Montana, and South Dakota. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, those three seem likely to fall to the Republicans, and that gets them halfway there, provided the Republicans don't lose any of their own seats.
Okay, then how about we add these? Alaska, Dan Sullivan seems to have a little lead over Mark Begich, although polls in Alaska are so unreliable, right?
That's true. Most of them have had Sullivan in the lead, but it is a notoriously very difficult state to poll.
And Arkansas, you have Tom Cotton with a slight lead over Mark Pryor. 6 years ago, Pryor, the Democrat, ran unopposed, and now he could lose his seat.
Yeah, it really underscores just the big Republican swing that's taken place in Arkansas. Republicans have, you know, most of the federal offices there. They don't have the governorship, although that very well may fall to them as well. It's a state Obama lost by more than 23 points, and that was when he was more popular than he is today.
Okay, and New Hampshire, nobody thought Jean Shaheen would be in any kind of trouble, but her race against Scott Brown looks pretty close.
Yeah, New Hampshire is an interesting state in that in, you know, 2006, 2008, which were so-called national wave years for Democrats, you know, the Democrats won all the big seats in New Hampshire as well. 2010, a very good Republican year. You know, Republicans won the two House races there. They won the Senate race there overwhelmingly. 2012, it seemed to dip back to the Democrats. So it seems like New Hampshire, also a swing state in presidential elections, is going to vote pretty closely to what the national trends are.
And in Iowa, you have a big battle for Tom Harkin's seat. It's Republican Joni Ernst against Democrat Bruce Braley. Kathy Obradovich is a political columnist at the Des Moines Register. She's covering the race, and she's on the line now. Kathy, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Ken. Thanks for having me.
We keep hearing that this year it's the Republicans with the momentum and the enthusiasm, and the Democrats are on the defensive. What are you seeing in Iowa?
Well, we have been neck and neck in this race, really from the primary in June. Right now, however, it looks like Joni Ernst, the Republican, is pulling a little bit ahead in the polls, although it is still really too close to call.
It was widely reported that Ernst blew off meeting with the editorial board of the Des Moines Register, and then we had Michelle Obama calling the Democrat Bruce Braley about four or five times. How much do voters care about those kind of things?
Well, you know, they make the news cycles, and any day that your candidate has a good news cycle, you know, you can say that you won that day, probably. Yes, Michelle Obama mispronounced Bruce Braley's name 7 times when she was here in Des Moines a couple of weeks ago, but then she came back to Iowa City and said his name correctly, you know, 12 times, and of course then the story is, well, she got it right this time. You know, Bruce Braley also had Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, and Mitt Romney, who has been here for Joni Ernst, has been a good surrogate for her as well.
We always talk about the gender gap and how Republican candidates, they had the weakness with female voters. But I remember early, one of your polls showed Braley with an even bigger deficit among male voters. Is that still the case?
That is still the case. Braley is ahead with women, but behind with men by more than he is ahead with women. So they are still trying to double down on the female vote. Hillary Clinton, for example, talking about how it's not enough to be a woman. You have to fight for women and women's issues. Obviously, directly speaking against Joni Ernst, one of the issues that they've really hit hard here is Joni Ernst having co-sponsored a personhood amendment to the Constitution, essentially giving the rights of personhood from the point of conception. So that has been an issue here, and also equal pay for equal work. They're also tying the issue of the minimum wage increase to benefiting women as well.
That's Kathy Obradovich, a political columnist at the Des Moines Register. Kathy, thanks so much.
All right. Thanks, Ken.
Greg, so what do you make of North Carolina? We haven't talked about that one yet. Some are portraying it as a battle between an uninspiring Democratic incumbent, Kay Hagan, and the leader of a very right-wing state legislature, Tom Tillis.
What strikes me about the North Carolina race is just how much spending, outside spending, has gone on there. The Center for Responsive Politics reports that over $58 million in outside money has been spent on that race. Ads have run over 100,000 times in that North Carolina Senate race.
The most expensive race in the country, Senate race in the country, right?
That's right. And what Hagan is trying to do is trying to paint Tillis as out of the mainstream by using his state legislative position. He's the state House Speaker against him by claiming that he has voted for education cuts. And education is a kind of a big issue in a state with so many research areas and universities.
Okay, so we've talked about 8 or 9 Democratic seats, but then there's the Republican seats themselves. There's Kentucky, where Republican Mitch McConnell is battling Alison Lundergan Grimes. Polls show the race is close, but McConnell hasn't put this one away. What should our listeners know?
The polls show that McConnell hasn't put it away, but he seems to have a small but, you know, persistent lead in those surveys. I think from the very beginning, the path to a Democratic victory over Mitch McConnell was feasible, but was always going to be a narrow path. I think Alison Lundergan Grimes always had a very high ceiling but a low floor. That is to say, against Mitch McConnell, he could probably get 47.5% of the vote, but it's very hard to get 50% plus one against him.
And what in the world is going on in Kansas? This is a state that last defeated a Republican Senate candidate in 1932. But Pat Roberts is in trouble, not for not living in the state, for being, according to some, out of touch. And now he has just one opponent, an independent named Greg Orman, who for a long time had a considerable lead against Roberts in the polls. But that race has reportedly tightened. Steve Kraske is with member station KCUR and a columnist for the Kansas City Star. Steve, Republicans were in a sense of panic a month ago, or maybe a month or two ago, when polls showed Orman with a sizable lead. What's happened since?
Well, they're still panicking, Ken. There's no question about it. The race has tightened, though, very much within the margin of error now. Orman seems to hold a slight advantage within the margin of error, but that doesn't mean that Republican fears have eased at all. Between the Senate race and the governor's race involving incumbent Republican Sam Brownback, just a lot of panic, a lot of concern, lots and lots of national money flowing into Kansas in a way we've never seen it before out here, given just how close both of these races are.
Well, Orman has indicated, he has not indicated what party he would vote for to organize, so
no.
Maybe that's why Pat Roberts keeps saying he, you know, a vote for Orman is a vote for Harry Reid.
That's right. It's unclear. Orman hasn't said which way he would go. In a sense, he's trying to have it both ways. You know, I have some leanings and some empathy with Republicans. I feel the same way. I'm simpatico with Democrats. He's trying to, you know, corral everybody. And so you don't know. And Roberts has banged on him repeatedly on this idea of, we don't know, you know, which side you're on. Stand up. Tell us who you're for. Orman has repeatedly refused to answer the question. question.
And then there's this other race you alluded to earlier, the governor's race with Sam Brownback in some kind of trouble. That must be having some kind of effect on the Senate race.
No question about it. And the fact that we're sitting here, Ken, having this conversation as these two stalwart Republicans in the reddest of red states in this country are both in trouble is just an absolutely staggering proposition to those of us out here in the heartland, sort of akin to the Kansas City Royals being in the World Series. None of it really quite makes any sense. You keep trying to read it in the papers and listen to it on the radio and make sure you're hearing it right. But that's exactly where we are out here. It's very quiet, but underneath the surface here, so much ill at ease, so much panic among Republicans that they could see, of all states in the union, Kansas slip away from them this year.
That's Steve Kraske of KCUR and the Kansas City Star. Steve, thanks so much.
Ken, always glad to do it.
You're listening to the Political Junkie Midterm Election Special. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Greg, in addition to Kansas and Kentucky, Republicans have to be concerned about Georgia. You have Michelle Nunn, the daughter of the former U.S. Senator Sam Nunn. She's using the issue of job outsourcing to attack the Republican David Perdue, put him on the defensive. What's happening there?
Well, that's a race that's become very highly competitive within the last few months. I think if you'd asked me, that the Republican David Perdue would probably have an advantage and probably would win enough, a majority vote, to win the election outright and avoid a runoff. But it's increasingly likely that we're going to go to a runoff in that election. And that election, if it's held, it would be on January the 6th, which is 3 days after the scheduled start of the next Congress. You have a third candidate in that race, a Libertarian, who may keep both Nunn and Perdue below the 50% plus one needed to win outright.
So we may not know who controls the Senate until January 6th.
Well, January 3rd is the constitutional start of the next Congress. But yes, technically, the runoff election in Georgia will be held 3 days after the new terms begin for the next session of Congress.
Greg Giroux is a political reporter with Bloomberg Politics. Thanks, Greg, for being on the program.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
And thanks also to Steve Kraske, Kathy Obradovich, and Jeremy Alford. Coming up next on Ken Rudin's Political Junkie, governorships from Maine to Hawaii are up for grabs. We'll tell you which states to watch.
There's a lot of legislative activity on issues that matter to people, frankly, more than what happens in D.C.
That's up next. Stay tuned. I'm Ken Rudin.
On the Halloween edition of Fresh Air, we enter the Funhouse of Fear with Stephen King. His novel Joyland is set in an amusement park. A teaser for the book says, "Beyond the lights, there is only darkness."
Read the line again.
You like it that much? You want to hear it again?
Can I write or what?
God.
Just kidding.
Stephen King on the next Fresh Air.
Weekday mornings at 11 and again at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Bavir Cafe. Bavir Cafe offers specialty coffee and breakfast, featuring a choice of cold and hot breakfast items, Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Bavir Cafe is staffed and managed by U of I hospitality students.
Welcome back to the Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. It's time to reveal the answer to last week's trivia question and tell you who wins the coveted Political Junkie button. Last week's question was inspired by this year's World Series matchup between the Kansas City Royals and the San Francisco Giants.
Sandoval in foul territory. Giants win!
Well, the Royals gave it their best shot, but the Giants won, their third championship in the past 5 years. But when was the last time the American League team won the World Series the same year as the Republicans won control and Democrats lost control of the Senate? The answer, 2002. The Anaheim Angels won the World Series, beating the Giants, when the Republicans won control of the Senate with a net gain of 2 seats.
Erstad says he has it. The Angels, world champions!
Republicans won back that control of the Senate after losing it when Jim Jeffords of Vermont left the GOP to vote with the Democrats the year before. And the randomly chosen political junkie with the correct answer is Daniel Fox of Lithopolis, Ohio. He gets the coveted Political Junkie button and a lifetime of bragging rights. And now to Scuttle Button, that weekly contest where we put up a series of buttons on our website, and your goal is to come up with a solution by picking out one word or concept per button. Here's the answer to last week's puzzle. The first button read, "If I were 21, I'd vote for Wilkie." the 1940 Republican presidential nominee. Then a button that read, "Guns don't kill people, people kill people." Another button with only the letter A on it, an anarchist button. And finally, a button that said, "Where's the loot?" So when you combine 21 and guns and and loot, you get, well, 21 guns a loot. And a 21-gun salute goes to Jeff Katz of Brookline, Massachusetts. Yes, it's the same Jeff Katz that won the Scuttle Button contest in November of 2009. So if my math is correct, that comes to a 42-gun salute for Jeff. If you want to play along with our favorite weekly waste of time exercise, go to our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com, and click on Scuttle Button. Now we'll look at the battles for the governorships around the country. In some of the bigger states, like California and New York, the races are not especially competitive. Jerry Brown and Andrew Cuomo aren't expected to face much difficulty from their Republican opponents. But what about Wisconsin and Scott Walker's presidential hopes? What about Florida with all that money being spent and that comforting electric fan? 36 governorships are at stake, and Reed Wilson of the Washington Post is here to walk us through them. We also have reporters out in the field in three closely watched races as well. Reed, welcome back to the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
The attention this year is clearly with the battle control of the Senate, but these gubernatorial contests are no small matter, are they?
No, they're not. As a matter of fact, while D.C. is more and more mired in gridlock and nothing gets done up on Capitol Hill or at the White House, out in the states, there's a lot of legislative activity on issues that matter to people, frankly, more than what happens in D.C., whether it's taxes or abortion or voting rights. These issues are coming up at in-state legislatures being acted on by governors, and they're coming up at an almost unprecedented rate.
The biggest one seems to be in Wisconsin. Scott Walker became a national conservative hero in 2011 when he beat back that recall effort by the Democrats and the labor unions. What's going on there?
In Wisconsin, Walker faces a former Trek bicycle executive named Mary Burke. She's a Madison school board member. She has not run as a traditional Democrat. She's sort of moved herself away from the labor union base of the Democratic Party in Wisconsin, and that's helped her. That's kept her very close in this race. Polls have shown it to be a very close race. A poll that came out on Thursday, however, shows Governor Walker leading by 7 points among likely voters, 50 to 43. The race is closer among registered voters. This gets down to sort of the story across the map right now. Who is going to turn out to vote? Can Democrats expand the electorate? If they can, Scott Walker has a real chance at going down on election night.
Another race that's drawn national attention is in Florida, where Rick Scott, a Republican barely elected 4 years ago, is facing his predecessor, Charlie Crist, a former Republican who switched to the Democrats. They seem to be locked in what appears to be a dead even race. Now, if you don't know anything about these candidates, you certainly know about their recent debate. Crist's use of a fan under his desk had Scott stewing backstage for 7 minutes before he came out for the debate. Adam Smith knows a lot about these candidates. He's the political editor for the Tampa Bay Times. Adam, welcome back to the Political Junkie.
Thanks, Ken.
Governor Scott has had a rocky 4 years in office. His approval ratings were always pretty dismal. How come?
You know, he barely squeaked by last time. It was a very nasty race. He won in obviously a big Republican wave election, spent $75 million of his own money, but still barely squeaked by. So he went into office not very popular, and he didn't have a lot of political skill. He had a rocky, you know, he campaigned sort of as a Tea Party candidate and initially started governing that way. And Florida is obviously a swing state that didn't go over very well.
But Charlie Crist has his own issues about popularity, doesn't he?
He sure does. Well, you know, there was always a storyline with Charlie Crist that, you know, likability ultimately matters so much in politics. And that's true. And if you ever see Charlie, if you see him on TV, and if you see him at an event, he's a very likable guy, almost a bizarrely likable guy. But, you know, tens of millions of dollars in negative ads, he's no longer so likable. So there's been $9,600 million in mostly negative ads, and most Floridians dislike both these guys more than they like them.
How big of an effect has Fangate had with the voters?
I don't know. There's been a couple polls. You know, there's so many mediocre polls, but most of them have not shown any direct impact. I think most of us were just embarrassed again to be Floridians in an election with Fangate.
The approval numbers for both candidates seem to be so low, it seems to be almost like a not the other guy they're voting for.
Yeah, it is, and it's and the but the other odd thing also is that turnout so far in these early with the early voting is pretty good. So the conventional wisdom about negative ads and there's no question people are holding their nose in this election, but they are voting, and I just don't really have my mind around that. I do know whoever wins is gonna, you know, neither of these candidates has really talked much about sort of a vision for the future. They've basically talked about how bad the other person has done as governor, and so whoever wins has got a lot of work to do to govern, I think, effectively.
Adam Smith is a political editor for the Tampa Bay Times. Adam, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, here's something that no one has ever said in our lifetimes. Ready? The governor of Pennsylvania is likely to lose. Okay, the last time that happened was 1854. What has Tom Corbett, the Republican, done that's jeopardized his job?
Well, Tom Corbett has been beset by scandal and bad press and just bad PR from the beginning of his administration. When he was the attorney general, his office declined to, dragged its feet on investigating Jerry Sandusky in the Penn State case. There were a lot of scandals in Harrisburg. The economy, at a time when so many other states are showing budget surpluses, Pennsylvania is about $1 billion in the hole. And he's just not a very good politician. He hasn't been able to connect with voters. That means that public polls have shown his Democratic opponent, Tom Wolf, a former member of a previous administration, who's also a wealthy businessman, is leading by a lot. He was leading by about 20 points to begin the race. The race is now tightened, as I say, to between about 10 and 15 points.
One state the Democrats were once pretty excited about was Texas. It hasn't elected a Democrat to the governorship since 1990, Ann Richards. But they had a candidate, Wendy Davis, with a seemingly stirring biography and an abortion filibuster that made national headlines. But then questions started getting asked about her life story, about her campaign strategy. And now the Republican candidate, State Attorney General Greg Abbott, is thought to have a double-digit lead. Wayne Slater, the senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News, is here with the lowdown. Great to have you back on the show.
Great to be with you.
So the Democratic comeback in Texas, what happened to it?
Well, you're right. Wendy Davis, this rather extraordinary, interesting state senator who was going to be the new Ann Richards, turned out not to be the new Ann Richards. She's much more reserved in her approach. And more importantly, she's trying to run after two decades of Republican hegemony in the state. A state, frankly, where the economy is okay. If you want to throw out the bombs, you got to basically make an argument. And her argument isn't very persuasive to some Republicans who say, you know, the economy's okay. And I hear this Republican opponent, the Attorney General Greg Abbott, a conservative, mentioned Barack Obama at every turn. So it's a very tough mountain, was always going to be a tough mountain for her to climb.
She had, you know, all this national acclaim when she did the abortion filibuster on the floor. I think the Texas legislature, it was shown nationally. I mean, everybody was just watching it. And she got this national cult hero image, and yet that didn't translate well in Texas.
Well, it didn't. I mean, this is a fairly conservative state. And if you look at the issues, I was traveling with her in recent days, and she's pushing the issue of equal pay. She's pushing the issue of more money for public education. Her opponent, Greg Abbott, has been defending in court a $5 billion cut in education by the conservative Texas legislature, and raising the minimum wage. Those are not issues that are persuasive to many voters in a state that's so Republican. It got so bad that by this midweek this week, Greg Abbott was accusing her of being soft on cattle rustling during a trip to the Cowboy Hall of Fame. So now it's really getting serious.
Well, Wendy Davis got into some controversy over a recent ad that alluded to Abbott being in a wheelchair. Explain what happened there. And is that a big deal?
Well, frankly, it is a bit of a big deal. Among the Republicans who support Greg Abbott, helped everything that fires up this Republican conservative base saying you ought to vote contributes to his success. Essentially, Greg Abbott was struck by a tree in 1985 and paralyzed, has been in a wheelchair ever since. One of the things he has done as a good, strong Republican is supported tort reform, the limitations on others and their ability to file lawsuits when they've been injured. And so the ad points out that what they call, the Wendy Davis people call hypocrisy, what others would say a disconnect, and that is, here is a Republican who was injured and had the benefits of a legal system that paid him millions. He has a multi-million dollar annual, six-figure annual income as a result of this, but then has pulled up the ladder for those who come after him. That's what the ad purported to show, and it did. And frankly, if you look at it specifically, it's totally legitimate. The problem is that it was easy to be misconstrued or to be construed by the Republicans as an attack on a guy in a wheelchair. Not very good politics, good policy, bad politics.
Wayne Slater is a senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News. Wayne, thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
You're listening to the Political Junkie Midterm Election Special. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. One Democratic governor thought to be living on borrowed time is Pat Quinn in Illinois. He took over after the impeachment, resignation, and prison sentence for Rod Blagojevich, who was famously trying to sell Barack Obama's Senate seat and other bits of corruption. Amanda Vinicky covers state politics for Illinois Public Media and WUIS in Springfield. Amanda, welcome back to the Political Junkie.
Thanks so much. Love being here.
Well, Pat Quinn has not had an easy time as governor. I mean, he may not be corrupt. He may not be end up in prison, as some of your recent governors have. But he has problems.
Huge problems. He had a hard hand dealt to him in the very beginning. Blagojevich left a pretty messy budget in his wake. In a $100 billion long-term liability for state pensions. And so Governor Pat Quinn has had to deal with all of that, and it hasn't been easy. He signed into law an income tax increase with only Democratic support, and that is set to expire at the start of the new year. So that has been one of the major issues in this race, with Republican Bruce Rauner calling for that to roll back and Quinn saying that he wants to make it permanent. That's, of course, something that no voter likes to hear.
Why isn't Rauner running away with this race?
Oh, yes. Well, he has strengths. He is for sure not beloved. The Quinn administration has, from the onset, tried to make an issue of his wealth, and Rauner has, frankly, fed right into that. So at a time where we hear all the time in headlines nationwide about income inequality and the problems that that has, you have basically one of Illinois' richest men that has the GOP nomination, and he has now said that he would be all right with a minimum wage increase as long as it is accompanied by business improvements. But you have videos of him calling for scaling back the minimum wage. You don't want to hear that from a multimillionaire.
And you have a Democratic candidate who's welcoming the president into the state, which is not the case in all states.
Oh, very much welcoming. I mean, huge rallies. And hey, look at this. We've had several commercials cut by First Lady Michelle Obama as well. So there's that. There's also, as you touched on, this matter of unions. It was widely seen that Quinn was going to have some big trouble because he had hurt that traditionally Democratic base when he signed into law an overhaul of state pensions, trying to deal with this major, as I had indicated earlier, $100 billion unfunded liability. And so unions didn't like that. But then Republicans went ahead and gave the nomination to Bruce Rauner, perhaps the only candidate that unions could hate more. So now you see unions are not just backing Pat Quinn, but they're going full throttle behind him. Rauner, during the primary, had made a lot of comments against quote-unquote big government union bosses. He says that it's not that he's anti-union, and yet he does cite often as his role models some of the governors that you've talked about, Governors Snyder and Walker and Kasich. And that really scares Illinois, where you have had years of unions that have a great machine going for both getting out the vote and for contributing to candidates, and that has most definitely propped up Quinn in his chances for re-election.
Well, I heard that some Chicago voters are so discouraged with the election that many of them are planning on voting only once.
For a change in Illinois, right?
Amanda Vinicky covers politics for Illinois Public Media. Amanda, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks so much. It was great, Ken.
Reed Wilson, let's go talk about other states with Democratic governors where the outcome is uncertain. Colorado, that's a fascinating story.
Governor John Hickenlooper has had he had tremendous success early in his career. He is sort of Colorado's mayor. He shows up at the ribbon cuttings, at all the feel-good moments, but he's gotten a bit of a reputation for avoiding some tough leadership decisions, whether it's in a death penalty case that made huge headlines out in Colorado, and he wasn't sort of put it off and put it off and put it off and finally said, well, he might commute this sentence if he loses re-election. He said that on television, which isn't great. Republicans made big hay out of that. The state legislature went very far to the left on issues like guns and voting rights and energy taxes and the environment, and probably farther to the left than he was comfortable with, but he ended up signing a lot of those bills, so sort of the legislature has put him in this position as well. His opponent is a former congressman named Bob Beaupre. Beaupre has put a lot of his own money into the race, but you're not really seeing the national investment from the Republican Governors Association, but Hickenlooper is in for a much closer election than he expected just 4 or 5 months ago.
Georgia, what's happening there?
Nathan Deal, like some of the other governors we talked about, is simply not popular. Nathan Deal's response to the big snowstorm in Atlanta earlier this year really hurt him with voters. He's got a lot of personal baggage, ethical baggage involving the State Ethics Commission. The Democrat is State Senator Jason Carter. You might recognize that name, especially from Georgia, because he is Jimmy Carter's grandson. And one sort of hint that I got that Deal thinks that he's going to be in trouble is that on the campaign trail the other day, he said, watch out for Jason Carter. He'll use it as a stepping stone to the White House, sort of bringing Jimmy Carter back into the race. One weird curveball about this Georgia election, if no candidate gets 50%, they go to a runoff. However, they don't go to the same runoff that the Senate race would go to in January. The state runoffs happen the first week of December. It's a weird, weird rule.
The headline, the governor's headline on Tuesday, is that Scott Walker, you think?
I think the headline is the bums get thrown out. Whether or not Walker loses, I think Walker is probably going to hold on, but there are going to be a surprising number of governors who get turned out of their bids for a second term. The last time we saw multiple governors lose in a cycle back in 1994 when five governors lost, I think we're going to exceed that number this year.
Reed Wilson is a reporter with the Washington Post. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Ken.
And thanks to Adam Smith of the Tampa Bay Times, Wayne Slater of the Dallas Morning News, and Amanda Vinicky of Illinois Public Media. That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible by the generous folks at WAMU 88.5 in Washington and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.